We are the ones we've been waiting. We are the ones.
We are the ones
we've been waiting.
We are the ones.
We are the ones
we've been waiting.
Is a group of women who came together to form a programming collective to deal with issues focusing on women as workers, artists, and all the other things that we are.
Good morning, everybody. My name's Joyce. Let's all introduce ourselves. The FMFEMME Radio Collective. Again, my name's Joyce.
Good morning. My name is Debbie. I'm a part of the Women's Collective and glad to be here.
Prairie Miller.
Good morning. Steffi Brooks here.
Catherine Arnaldi.
Galena Winterbrook.
And I'm Ariel Sinnott.
It was Galena Winterbrook and Ariel Sinnott who are in studio. And good morning to all the FM Radio Collective folk who are not here right now, like Ife and Serene. Very briefly, our theme, we generally work with a theme, and the theme for today is bad. And Catherine, you have some ideas
as
on bad.
As in go on with your bad self, as in throwing off terms that are placed upon us and looking around and drawing our own conclusions about what we see and what we are.
My understanding of bad came from a book, Too Good for Her Own Good. It's by Claudia Bebko and Joanne Krestan, K-R-E-S-T-A-N. And there are some codes of what good girls live by. Apparently it's be attractive. A woman is as good as she looks. Be a lady. A good woman stays in control. Be unselfish and of service. A good woman lives to give. Make relationships work. A good woman loves first. Be competent without complaint. A good woman does it all and never looks overwhelmed. So I guess anything that's opposed to that would be bad.
And I'm bad and I'm proud.
There you go. So we're going to come back with some news. Stay tuned.
She likes to watch things blow up. Then she walks away. An infant in a man. What can anybody say? But recoil from the madness. An infantile. You're
the latest news about women from FEM Radio. Women are making a difference around the world, especially in Latin America. Nearly 40% of the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia Guerrilla Army, or FARC, are females, and they are credited by the FARC as being instrumental in successfully liberating 40% of the country from the U.S.-backed Colombian government. The FARC also have their own female heroes, heroines in history, namely the Amazons, who put up fierce resistance to the European colonial invaders. The FARC women, or guerrilleras, say in a decree that as Colombian revolutionaries, they have attained a new notion of love in that now they can love men because they want to and not because they have to, due to economic dependence on them.
In Japan, passenger cars reserved for women only are being added to rush hour commuter trains in response to complaints from women of being groped and fondled on the crowded ride into work.
Women are also playing a key role in Venezuela's Bolivarian circles. Though demonized as gangs by Venezuela's economic elite, a version picked up here in the U.S. corporate media, the more than 1 million strong members of the Bolivarian Circles movement run 24-hour daycare centers for poor single working mothers, assist in neighborhood repairs, distribute food, help people to access health clinics, and run their own neighborhood radio and TV stations. One of the Circle's founders is Lina Ron, head of the People's Power Network, and she leads 45 of the Circles. Her second in command is also a woman, Rosa Gonzalez. On a side note, Lina Ron burned a U.S. flag in the center of Caracas in protest against the, quote, terrorist aggression when U.S. jets were bombing Afghanistan. It was also the Bolivarian Circles, many of them women, who collectively foiled the U.S.-backed coup attempt against elected President Hugo Chavez when they took to the streets in an astonishing show of people power to defend him.
Military discharges for breaking the don't ask, don't tell policy on sexual orientation have reached record levels, according to a recent report by the Service Members Legal Defense Network, and women are being discharged at a disproportionate rate. In 2001, the Defense Department fired 1,250 men and women for being gay, lesbian, or bisexual. Although women are only 14% of the total force, they were 30% of the service members discharged. The U.S. Air Force led the way. 43% of its gay discharges last year were women.
What have the major world powers brought to the dismantled former Yugoslavia besides grabbing, plundering, and profiteering off the socialist publicly owned industries there? For one, the sex trafficking of women and girls, perpetrated ironically by the outside peacekeepers sent there. A just released UN report says the buying and selling of women and girls under conditions of national disintegration is most rampant in Bosnia, Kosovo, Macedonia, Moldavia, and also Romania, Albania, and the former Soviet Union. Half the men exploiting these females are the NATO forces, according to the UN report. The report charges that every year, perhaps hundreds of thousands of these women are, quote, exploited, sold, tricked, and forced into situations of exploitation from which there is no escape.
And thank you for that news around the world related to women. Next, we'll have a film piece from Prairie Miller. Stay tuned. It's WBAI
99.5. We are the ones.
You dirty swine! I never cared for you, not once. I was always making a fool of you. You bored me stiff. I hated you. It made me sick when I had to let you kiss me. I only did it because you begged me. You hounded me. You drove me crazy. And after you kissed me, I always used to wipe my mouth. Wipe my mouth!
The nationwide Teamsters strike against the overnight trucking company is a fierce 3-year struggle, essentially pitting the union movement against the corporations, in this case against the real power behind overnight trucking, Union Pacific. The documentary American Standoff, directed by Christy Jacobson, tracks the Valiant Strike now in its third year. American Standoff is produced by Barbara Koppel, who gave us the extraordinary Kentucky coal miner strike documentary, Harlan County, USA. One gutsy Chicago female trucker we see in American Standoff, Hope Hempelman, has made a difference fighting alongside the mostly male striking Teamsters while struggling as a single mother to raise her five kids. Here are some scenes from American Standoff of Hope holding things together at home and on the picket line.
I'm a city driver for overnight transportation. I drive a tractor trailer. I have five kids at home. I'm a single mom.
You go find your sister.
When the issue of strike came into play, I needed it. I personally, come on, don't wipe it out of your eyes.
Whoa.
Basically, when the strike started to become a reality and the union actually started to step in and say, hey, wait a minute, you can't treat these people like this, the terminal was under completely different management, and I was being harassed considerably. Mm-hmm. It was terrible.
All right.
I'm the only woman in my terminal with 74 men. My feeling is my manager is not happy with a woman being in his barn, and he wants me out. They're trying to push me out. Unfortunately, they don't realize what a big mouth I have, and I'm not going to just sit back anymore.
Giving them a piece of my mind.
I sat down to talk with American Standoff director Christy Jacobson, who has spent the past 3 years with Hope and the other strikers living, breathing, and filming them in battle. Why, of the different strikes going on, did you pick the Teamsters strike against overnight trucking to make a movie about?
The reason we focused on the Teamsters strike against overnight transportation is because it represents so much of what's going on in the American labor movement today and the obstacles that both unions and working people face when trying to unionize. Because of the big power and money that corporations have and the way the laws are set up to protect the corporations rather than the workers.
Why did you choose the particular workers and unionists you did to film their stories and their words?
Of course, meeting Hope Hempelman in Chicago, you know, I sort of knew before we even started rolling the camera, this one's going to be a fireball. And, you know, I was lucky in that we met a lot of people along the way, and everyone has such an interesting story and struggled along the way. But these people that we filmed really were able to capture the essence of what working people are going through right now and certainly captured my heart.
What did you come to most admire about these strikers?
I think what I most admire about the strikers that I met along the way making American Standoff is their resolve and determination. And, you know, when they decided to join the union, they were already taking a risk. And then when they decided to walk out on strike, they were taking another risk. And they just sort of continued to move forward because of what they believed in, and they sacrificed so much. And a lot of people in today's society aren't that willing to sacrifice the things in their lives for something they believe in. And these people did that and never really looked back.
What was the most moving or overwhelming experience for you while making the film?
One of the most moving moments for me in the making of this film was going with Joe Reeves to the cemetery where much of his family had been buried. And he took me to the grave of his uncle. And there, engraved on the tombstone, was an overnight truck. And I think at that moment, it became so clear to me how much this company meant to this man and the internal struggle that he was going through in deciding to walk out on that company because of his belief in the union. And his, I guess it was just this look in his eye. It was, there was fear and, but mostly pride in himself as an individual that really just moved me. Another thing that really moved me was just being with Hope Hampelman and her children and the love that abounds in their house and the sense of her great pride in doing what she thinks is right and setting an example for her children who really look up to her.
You've made several films now with Barbara Koppel. Are there problems or challenges specific to you as women caught up in real, sometimes volatile situations?
I actually think working with Barbara Koppel, I learned that being a woman doesn't present an added challenge. It presents a strength. And while you find yourself when you're making documentaries in a situation often where you don't know what's going to happen next and you can't control what's happening, the most important thing is to trust your instincts and not think that these are your instincts and they're your women instincts. They're just your instincts and you have to trust them. It is difficult at times. Actually, also, I think because of our equipment, which was a DV camera, which was kind of small. Often when we were shooting, our cinematographer, Kirsten Johnson, is also a woman. And people would sort of say, like, oh, you must be students. And, you know, they just wouldn't take us seriously because we were girls. It seemed like that sometimes. And then you just had to tell them, actually, you should really take us a little more seriously than you are. And, you know, we just tried I just always try and present my strengths rather than think of being a woman as a weakness.
American Standoff is airing on HBO and HBO Latino through July 1st. The film is also being screened at labor events. For information about organizing a screening, contact Catalyst Films at NewYorkCatalyst@AOL.com. That's NYCATALYST@AOL.com. Or telephone them at 212-539-0909. That's 212-539-0909. Here are some final scenes from American Standoff of Hope Hempelman at a national meeting, bracing to lead her union to victory. This is Prairie Miller.
I believe in what I'm doing. I believe I'm right. It's about me not being kicked around anymore. It's about me standing up and fighting and saying, hey, I've had enough. I've learned I have, I don't know if it's willpower, stubbornness, or pride. I don't know which one, maybe all of them. But I'm not going to give up. I'm not going to go away.
I'm shaking like a leaf.
Of its life with overnight, and we have to make sure that we guarantee the fundamental rights of members to join a union. Let's welcome Hope Hempelman, an overnight striker from Chicago, Illinois.
Good morning, General President, Executive Board, My name is Hope Hampelman, and I am an overnight striker. I am honored to be here today. I have been on strike for 21 months. 21 very long months. We are facing down a corporate giant whose sole goal is to bust the union. We are in the midst of a historic struggle. With your help, with you guys, we will bring overnight to justice. As we all know, Teamsters United will never die. Teamsters United will never die. Teamsters United will never, ever die. Thank you very much.
I'm not bad. I'm just drawn that way.
You had plenty of money in 1922.
Thank you, Jessica Rabbit. Thank you, Prairie Miller, actually. And on the line, we have two guests.
Rita Naranjo was one of nine children, all of whom grew up in foster care and group homes. She had her first child at 15, followed by a second. Now, she has finished her third year of college, is an activist for the rights of teen moms, those in foster care and group homes, and has been in Washington several times to speak to Congress, and works as a youth advocate at a group home in San Diego.
Good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning, Rita.
How are you guys doing this morning?
Okay, we're good. Glad to have you here.
And on the line we also have Dolores Thrower, who's is a board member of the Women's Advocate Ministry, and an organization that provides advocacy for women going through the criminal justice system. Other experience that she has includes vocational training and employment placement for the homeless, substance abuse and mental health counseling at women's shelters, and outpatient treatment programs. Good morning, Dolores.
Good morning, Jackie.
I'm Joyce.
I'm sorry,
it's fine.
Joyce. You've been Jackie to me for a while now.
This is true. So, Catherine.
Rita, how did you come to be in foster care and group homes?
Well, my mom, actually had used drugs way before I was even born, had already started, her path, in the drug scene. And so when I was four, actually my father got killed in Colombia. And and after that, my mom kind of just went even further down. And she even tried to commit suicide at one point. And we just were removed from the home because she actually had left us for a while, because she was just, she was so devastated by the events with my dad and having, all these young children and not having any support. She just became isolated, and we ended up getting removed from her care. I was four, and at that time it was there was about six of us, and so we all were removed from the home. And I eventually ended up in group homes because, having grown up in the system in my teen years, that's when I really was in group homes. I just was so tired of being moved around from place to place and being where I didn't want to be and just wanting to be home. When I was placed in these group homes, I ended up just running away anyways. But I'd have to say, honestly, that my group home experience was somewhat better than my foster home experiences.
Dolores, does this story sound familiar to you?
Sounds very familiar, but it has a happier ending than I'm accustomed to.
So what are the hearings, the endings that you're generally hearing?
Well, as you know, Joyce, I've worked with women in homeless shelters, and our women come to us at age 18 and above. A lot of them have come from group homes and foster homes. They've been abused. They've been abused sexually, verbally, physically. And they come to us, and they have a lot of problems. And they're homeless. They have nowhere to go at that point in time, having outgrown the group home or foster care system. And they're at odds with no training, still lack of education, and serious psychological problems.
Rita, you've said that only 3% of children in foster care finish high school. What do you think are some of the reasons for this?
Some of the main ones, just, I mean, the impact that we have is, you know, from being moved from place to place and you know, developing a sense of that nobody cares. So that, I mean, that has a major impact on how we feel about ourselves. If we feel like that nobody in this world, you know, cares about us, you know, am I worth even caring about, you know, myself? You know, can I care about myself? And just, I mean, so that kind of is one element to failure, because, you know, how can I have any kind of hope in myself and my abilities, and then you not having any support in reality? You know, who's really trying to help me, and how can they help me? I don't have, you know, say, I mean, a lot of kids, even me, I can't, you know, ask my family, because I don't even really have any family other than my brothers, but my mom is still struggling. You know, and a lot of you know, young people don't have any support. So what do they turn to?
Dolores.
You know, and I mean, thankfully there's shelters and of course lack of anybody teaching us any life skills. You know, there's a lot of talk as far as that.
Rita, what do you think changed your life from that fate?
And I'd also like to know from Dolores what type of support you've offered. Rita first.
Okay. Honestly, of course, the major event that changed my life, of course, was having my daughter when I was 15. And I know that, you know, people would think, well, dang, you know, now you're going to have it even harder because, you know, not only have you grown up in the system, but now you're going to have a child to take care of as well without having any of the support and education and this and that. But you know, the day that I found out that I was pregnant, and even before that, I was really determined to, you know, or thought about what kind of life I was going to have. And I just, you know, somewhere along the line, I knew that education was really going to be my way up and out of poverty and being able to take care of myself and even help my own family. And I think that I just saw education as being what was going to help me. And there were certain things that I had to do that really made me feel kind of bad about myself, but then I was like, you know, I'm going to take advantage of the system. You know, I'm going to get on welfare, and I'm going to use that aid to put me through school, even though, you know, I really was afraid of, you know, attaching all those negative stigmas to myself. But I was like, you know what? You know, I'm not going to worry about what people are going to think of me. Okay, I'm a young teen mother. Yeah, I'm a former foster youth. Yeah, and people are going to shake their heads at me. But you know what? I'm going to do what I have to do. Take care of myself. Is that if I have to, you know, make people look at me, you know, look down on me even more, but that's not my concern. My concern is being able to survive. And, you know, so I've just been dedicating my life to school and being a mom and just trying to help other people out and, you know, instill that sense of hope and ability in young people and take advantage of the help that is out there.
And Dolores, before you respond, I just want to let people know that they're listening to FM Femme Radio on WBAI 99.5. Dolores.
Yes.
The type of support that you've offered or had available.
As you know, I've worked mostly with those women as they become adults, 18 and over. There are activities during the time that they're younger. I'm not quite as familiar with those, but there is a mentoring program that's ongoing for children in foster care, foster home, and group homes.
Well, you can mention the older women as well, because some women who don't get support are going to need it when they get older.
Absolutely. The one program that I'm familiar with that I've worked at for a while was BRC Horizons program, which is a vocational education and training program. They also offer referrals to GED preparation. And that would be at 212-553-5700.
Could you repeat that again, please?
212-553-5700. That's the Bowery Residence Committee Horizons program. The director of that program is John Ford. Additionally, if the person happens to be caught up in the criminal justice system, whether or not they're younger or older, for women, the Women's Advocate Ministry will support them through court and working with them to get their children back, to make certain everything is taken care of while they're going through the process. And if, unfortunately, they're incarcerated, they maintain that contact throughout that incarceration, helping the person with the needs during and referring them afterward. And that number would be 212-862-0124. The director of that program is Annie Bovian. And there are just numerous other programs for people with mental health issues, with substance abuse issues. Very easy to get them by just calling information. And there's just a wealth of information out there to help someone.
Rita, you have said that you're fighting for your equal rights to education. And I've heard you say that it's school that has reinforced your conclusions about what your experiences were. What did you mean by that? How has school reinforced what you observed and the conclusions that you had already drawn?
Well, one of the main things, and actually kind of exciting, you know, I kind of noticed that, you know, when I was in my classes, it's like the teachers are trying to teach, you know, the students about the issues that that exist in society, and it was just strange to me because I'm like, why are people having to be taught this? Don't they already know? Because a lot of those issues I had already experienced in my life, you know, whether being young, and even today, and it was just like, you guys have to be taught this, you know? It almost seems like you guys are should already know. I already kind of felt like I had somewhat an advantage of just understanding and knowing the issues, which is kind of unfortunate in a sense, but it's also a strength because, you know, I think I'll be better as a social worker, you know, having been through some of the struggles that I've been through and just being aware of some other things. And so just kind of reinforcing the strength in having those experiences, you know, really kind of gives me a sense of pride in a way. Seems kind of strange, but, you know, I can be proud that I've experienced the things that I have because, in a way, it gives me, as my teacher would call, a competitive advantage.
Dolores. Dolores?
Yes.
What do you have to, how are you in interacting with different organizations and groups not having had this experience or this exposure? Or, you know?
My experience just comes through the training in substance abuse and social services, and specifically wanting to work with minorities. And in wanting to work with minorities, you come through a lot of issues. That's the social welfare system, the children's welfare system, substance abuse, and whatever. And it's not... it's not so far away from an experience that I've had, although I haven't had the group home experience. Mm-hmm. One-third of all African-American men are incarcerated, and that's incarceration starts in childhood, whether that be through group homes, whether it be actual criminal justice incarceration. We all know someone who's been there. We can all empathize with the situation, and it's just something that I wanted to work with and ensure that the system's a little bit more fair and that people get an opportunity to make something else of their lives.
Dolores, have you encountered any persons and many young women who feel are made to feel bad as a result of their experience? that got them to the group home?
Many of the young women who get into the group homes are coming into the group home quite scarred. They're coming from families that have broken up as a result of incarceration. They're coming from families that have broken up because of drugs and alcohol. A lot of those issues come with children when they go into group homes and into foster care. The real key is trying to give them the self-esteem, making them feel better about themselves, giving them some security at that point in time. And as Rita's mentioned, it's very difficult, and a lot of them don't get it until later on.
Rita, you've been to Washington several times to speak to Congress. Can you tell me who you went with, why, and what was that experience like?
Yeah, I went with the Welfare Made a Difference campaign, out of New York, or organized out of New York, I believe. And I was invited to participate in that because welfare did make a difference in my life. And I wanted to be able to, or I kind of volunteered kind of being representative of that. And it was cool that I was invited to go. And, you know, there was some encouraging and discouraging parts of that, but you know what was encouraging is that I can be representative of people who have went through the welfare system and it has made a difference, but it could have helped them even more, and how it could help people more today. And so I was able to talk about that, but it was kind of discouraging because I could be on the verge of tears and still get responses like, well, that's too liberal. So that kind of hurt my feelings personally, because I just couldn't understand how people can't understand that and not care about the issues that people face. So that was kind of a rude awakening. I mean, I kind of figured, I had a sense of that anyways, just, in general about different things or just how the society is, but it kind of reinforced those things as far as, there are people who don't care because it doesn't fit with their personal agendas or their, what they feel like they have to gain.
We want to open up the phones now and,
okay.
And
yeah, it looks as though it looks as though there are a couple of people who are interested.
Oh, great.
And the number to call is 212-209-2900. That's 212-209-2900.
Let's take a call. The first caller. Hello, you're on WBAI. Hello.
Turn down your radio.
Yeah.
Hello. I'm sorry, I had the radio up so loud.
Yeah, it's okay. Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Rick. What's up, Joyce?
Hi, Rick. How you doing? You have a question for the guest?
Yeah, well, more or less, I wanted to make a statement.
Make it quick.
Well, basically, what the young lady Rita's talking about,
okay.
I've been to that exact same situation my entire life. Since I was 3 years old, I was taken away from my mother and my father. I was never raised around my sister or my brothers. The system, I heard her say that only 3% of kids that come out of that foster care system eventually, be successful. I'm just going to make the guess that I would imagine that a large percentage of that 3% is females, because, of me coming through a lot of foster homes and group homes up until the age I was 19, when they kicked me out, they didn't give me anything. They just told kick me out. I was in four foster homes, about five group homes, about two institutions my entire life. After they kicked me out. And so I really, really had to struggle. I ended up going to jail back and forth. And well, I've seen some females that went through the same thing, but a lot of them was able to, a lot of them was able to adapt, I guess, when some of them went out and sold their bodies, but some of them were able to find boyfriends that took them in or whatever. Where I was just saying, hard as she had it, I've been through the exact same thing, and just that it never stopped for me. And when y'all made the connection from institutions or coming up in group homes and institutions, then following up with jail, it's almost like they're preparing you for the jail system, mm-hmm. in a lot of ways. It's almost like they're preparing you for it, because that's exactly the way my course of life went. And that's all I really wanted to say is, I'm proud of the young lady Rita. I just wish that there were more systems. Saying protect, men and women.
All right, thanks a lot, Rick.
We have other callers on the line.
All right.
Thanks for listening.
Hello, you're on WBAI.
Oh, yeah, hi. This is Rose Capello Conforti. I'm a friend of Catherine Arnaldi's. And I'm calling in because I lived in a group home myself when I was about 13.
Hey, Rose, how are you doing? You're on the air. Thank you so much. I wonder if you could tell how you, what your group home experience was.
Very quickly.
Okay, it was 1976. Sure. I was being very, very heavily abused by my parents, my father particularly, and I somehow decided on my own that I needed to get out. And that's what I did. I went to my social workers at school, and they said, okay, I said, I want to live somewhere else. And we got in touch with a group home, and I left, and I lived in a group home. And you know what? It was a freeing experience. It was not an incarceration. It was a freeing experience because, again, it was 1976. So my question would be, how do you instill today in the group homes this feeling of freedom and the potential to transcend your past?
Dolores, Rita, you want to respond to that?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question, Joyce.
The caller had wanted to know, how do you instill a sense of freedom when you're in a group home?
To transcend your past.
Right.
There is a power. You as an individual, anyone as an individual has a power to transcend their past. And how are group homes working towards that?
Go ahead.
Well, it's a little heavy question.
This is Rita. Well, in San Diego County, they have this program called Youth to Youth, which I'm a youth advocate with the Youth to Youth program. And the youth advocates were all former foster youth. And we're going back into the system, you know, being, you know, role models, mentors, and educators, peer educators to current foster youth, and how we're, you know, I mean, one of my main focuses is to really let them know that they can have hope for better days, that these experiences are only going to last for so long. I mean, everybody's situation is different, you know. I mean, I know the guy that just called, Rick, you know, people have ongoing struggles, but there's, you know, you can instill that, you know, the future can be brighter. You know, the future can and will be different, but we have, you know, a part in making that better. Mm-hmm. And so they got to, you know, you got to instill that they have a sense of responsibility, you know, for them, and that they have some power and control in their lives.
Dolores, is there something you want to add to that? And this will be sort of like a closing response.
There is a program in New York called Mentoring USA where people can volunteer to be mentors to children in group homes and foster care. That number is 212-253-1194. And then the other thing is children can be their own advocates. They should reach out. If things aren't going well, reach out. Go to different agencies. Find out what additional help is available to those to you as a recipient of group home services. It shouldn't all be bad. And advocacy for oneself should start as young, very young. Just like this lady says that she left because her home situation wasn't going well. Well, the same thing can be done in foster care or in group homes.
Can you repeat that phone number, please?
The number mentoring. Is to Mentoring USA,
yes.
And the number is 212-253-1194.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Rita and Dolores.
Thank you. I had a great experience.
Thank you, Joyce.
Thank you.
And thank you all the people who called in, and I wish we could take more. We're going to move forward to our next segment, which was contributed by FM Radio's IFE. IFE has also has participated with Orature, which was Monday nights at 10 p.m. Stay tuned.
Like a whip,
get it mixed up. Bad little sister, not bad meaning bad, but bad meaning good. Damn, I'm so good.
Hi, I'm here with April Silvers. How are you doing?
Fine.
All right. April Silvers, tell everybody what it is that you do.
I am the founder and president of Aquila Work Songs, and basically what my company does, it's a multi-service arts and entertainment agency, and our work centers around, or is channeled through our speakers bureau, our public relations firm, and our consulting firm. And we, for the past 9 years, have been working to put on programs, to support artists, to provide resources and services that are about preserving and promoting the cultural arts, specifically in hip-hop. Not exclusively, okay. but that has been the lion's share of our work.
Okay. So now that everybody got a chance to get to know you a little better and what it is that you do, let me ask you a couple of questions. What kind of roles do you feel that female artists play today in hip-hop industry?
Well, on the recording side, and on either side, be it on the mic or behind the scenes, is definitely not proportionate to men in the roles that we play. And that's just how society is as a whole. So, but I'll just start off on the recording side. It depends on, you know, from what perspective or from what window you're looking out of. You could take someone like a Lauryn Hill and survey her work as a recording artist and see that she has a message to her music, that there's some real artistry there and what she does historically as an artist. And that's one perspective, of course. And you have recording artists on the other side, like Lil' Kim and what she represents in terms of recording artists, and where, you know, all you get is sex. Not even sexy, but just sex. You know what I mean? So, you know, you're going to have the full spectrum represented behind. And that's just not with hip-hop. That's just with art, period. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think in many ways we're very different from just the nature and the origin and just the dynamic movements of art.
Mm-hmm.
And same thing applies behind the scenes. You will find a lot of women, increasingly so, involved in leadership positions in terms of business, in terms of shaping people's careers. I know, for example, part of what we do at my company is public relations work, and that's a female-dominated aspect of entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, of course, like the heads of labels and other executive positions or managerial positions,
mm-hmm.
like managers and promotions or whatever, those are male-dominated.
Okay.
But in terms of public relations, for example, that's heavily female-dominated.
You know that FM, we're doing this thing, BAD. What do you think BAD means to you as far as the women in hip-hop industry, artists?
Well, let me expand it a little bit just in terms of, like, our cultural language and the history of our language, you know, as black people in this country. You know, we have a way of just the self-determining beings that we seek to be. We have a way of just putting our own meanings, our own color, our own texture into what we say, how we speak, what we dress. And BAD is just a simple example of that. You know, for us, it means good. You know what I mean? It means something that is positive, something that's hip, that's on, that's sexy and hot or whatever. You know what I mean? So, so that's from a cultural standpoint.
Well, let me ask you now what your feelings are about the women in music videos.
A lot of feelings.
Me too.
Yeah.
Believe me.
You know, I mean, that's a mouthful. You know what I mean? That what I think it speaks to, I recently heard a dancer talking about, I guess you could call her a reformed dancer. She was on the radio just talking about that lifestyle, that mentality, the mentality that begets a woman that would just present herself as pure sex, as pure object, you know, as where money and material things are the primary aspirations in life. And what it speaks to is just the fact that we don't believe as women that we have options,
mm-hmm.
you know, that we have choices, that while I am perfectly okay with women using their bodies in a powerful way,
mm-hmm.
you know what I mean, as I am with anybody using you know, that which is a natural gift. But what was problematic for me is when that is the primary source, you know what I mean? But as opposed to using our intellect, our intuition, our ability to think and create and build, that just becomes totally not even explored, not even, let alone respected, but it's not even explored as an option. And so we're battling against women's, the stereotypes of women. We're battling against what, as little girls, we're told how we're supposed to function, how we're supposed to relate to men, how we're supposed to get, make our ends meet, which is through sex. And that's problematic because it doesn't speak to all of who we are.
Yes,
we are naturally a powerful, creative, intuitive group of people, particularly black women in what we've gone through.
Mm-hmm.
And so what's problematic is that we don't see that in its full scope.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where a lot of the work comes in, just saying, you know, it would be different if women were fully exposed to their unlimited potential and then said, you know what, with that, I want you to pay me for taking my clothes off. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
one thing. But, you know, there's just a lot of untapped potential. You know, there's this sister who's a dear friend of mine on her outgoing message machine. Her message is, open your presence. You know what I mean? And it just speaks to, like, we have so many gifts. We have so many talents. We have so many powerful tools. And we're sitting here amongst all of our presence, and we're not opening them. We're not using them.
That's the truth.
So, but I kind of went way off on another level. I just, I don't know that we can really make the impact on women because, you know, their argument is very strong about what, you know, that work yields for them in terms of resources and material. You know, that's how they live.
Mm-hmm.
I think we need to just be in a position where we can make videos that are more creative. You know what I mean? That
exactly.
just expand more. So I don't know that we can stop people from making those kinds of videos of women or stop women from just doing that work. But we shouldn't pass judgment. I'm not really cool with just, you know, this fire and brimstone type approach to women's work. But what I am aggressive about is creating other opportunities for women.
Do you think that eventually, at some point in time, women will have a higher power position in the hip hop industry?
There's room. You know what I mean? There's
yeah.
room for us to come up. There's room for us to put some balance in this very, very lopsided
mm-hmm.
situation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm a very optimistic, hopeful person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's why, you know, people like myself and others, we cannot give up, you know,
mm-hmm.
because we have hope, as corny as that sounds. But if we look at, for example, if we compare that question to another realm, if that question were asked of artists in terms of, like, do you think artists would ever get to the point where they own what they create? Because that has been a historic problem,
mm-hmm.
and not just for black artists, but artists, period. If we can use that as a backdrop to how things can change,
mm-hmm.
Then we could confidently say that it's likely that women will come up, because we're in a state, like I always say, this generation of hip-hop heads represent the wealthiest group of black and Latino people, young people, the world has ever seen. We also have to get into higher levels of ownership and influence so that we can make room for women who say, that's cool over there, you do what you got to do, but let me tell the other side of the story. See, the story is not being told fully right now, and we can't expect corporate entertainment to tell our story right.
I guess if there's anything else you want to say, you know, as far as you're concerned, as far as what you're doing.
Yeah, we have some very solid projects that, you know, speaking of powerful women, there's a new artist that that I'll be working with and standing behind, Heather Smith. That'll be coming out in the real near future. And just to, you know, I don't know if it's appropriate to leave my contact information. Yeah, always got a plug, right? Aquila Work Songs is the name of the company, and the telephone is 718-756-8501. We've been in business since 93.
Wow.
Working in hip-hop and the cultural arts. My work started from Howard University and has maintained, so we're always looking for solid projects, even if we can't work with them immediately down the line, so... So we're here, don't I think? Saw the picture, Fox and Paw just quiet like a whisper. Don't get it mixed up, bad little sister. Not bad meaning bad, but bad meaning good. Damn, I'm so good, you should see me in them jeans. It's hard to describe it. Being cocky's just a part of my vibe. I might stop the hollering, pop my collar.
And you're listening to FM radio. And that was Ife. Yeah, stay tuned for Out FM's coming up next. We should be back on the 22nd of August. Yeah, excuse me, of July.
Okay, you were skipping over the entire month.
I am, aren't I?
Entire month of July there. And I believe that there is an announcement that I have to make, and it's about time to do it. Ariel Sinai will be performing in the West Village at upstairs at Rose's Turn at 55 Grove Street, which is just one block south of Christopher Street. And you can make a reservation by calling 212-366-5438. And that performance happens on July 12th at 9 p.m.
Also,
yes,
there is a Ms. Magazine giveaway. If you call, sorry, Fred, and I'll be there in a second, 212-209-2800. That's 212-209-2800. And you can get the anniversary edition of Ms. Magazine, Best of 30 Years, Poetry and Fiction. Thank you.